Don't ask me. I don't know. You just like what you like. You know, you just play what you play. You like what you like. It's like, what kind of treatment do you want? What kind of approach to a problem do you prefer? That's what I'm going to talk about today. I'm Graham Daniels, lead author of Getting Real About Sex Addiction, a psychodynamic approach to treatment. You know, hey, I like what I like. And this is the podcast entitled Getting Real About Sex Addiction. And we're going to continue with more on, actually, yes, going to revisit the subject of long-term versus short-term treatment. You know, why this has come about is because I've been rooting around, sort of looking at different resources recently, looking for guests. I had Eddie Capirucci on, you know, a week ago. I'm having ideas about others to get on. I want to get some more women in this conversation about getting real about sex addiction, particularly on the matter of female sex addicts. I got something on the way, I hope, but I'm going to be reticent about that for now. But in, you know, looking around and getting on websites and checking out resources that are out there, I continue to come across programs that market themselves in ways that I think irk me. So I'm just going to remark on that a little bit and get into, in particular, you know, this idea of short-term treatment versus the long-term psychoanalytic approach. Some programs are aimed, you know, they're not about long-term or short-term problem. They're about gender. You know, I notice in particular with Christian-style treatment approaches, the websites that treat sex addiction or problem sexual behavior, that is the more popular term currently, I find, their website information acts as if it's almost exclusively a male problem. I was looking at this one site. I'm not going to get into who it is, who the provider is, but they're listing stats about how many men are inclined towards, men or boys are inclined towards pornography or infidelity, all these other behaviors under the umbrella of sex addiction. You'd get the impression that female sex addiction, you know, doesn't exist. You know, putting aside that, I also go look at, you know, ads or websites for, you know, treatment programs that are short-term, in effect. And what do I mean by short-term? I'm talking about this, feature of addiction treatment that we dub rehab. This is if you, there's a, such a thing as rehab for sex addiction treatment program or workshops or retreats. This idea that you go off to someplace, you know, in the woods or someplace, somewhere luxurious, and, you know, you get to immerse yourself in your program for, you know, a handful of days or weeks, but probably just in terms of days. And the marketing here, I have to say, gets under my skin a little bit too. I read one whose pitch was something like, "In just a handful of days, you will receive the equivalent of a year's worth of counseling." No, you won't, I want to say. Because this conversation will get into what is counseling versus what is therapy, certainly in-depth therapy or psychoanalysis. What you get in a matter of days, okay, is instruction. And you might get very useful instruction, very immersive instruction, but to say what you get in a matter of days is equivalent to, say, a year's worth of, and forget counseling, I'll say something like in-depth therapy or psychoanalysis, is like saying that you get the same out of a basketball camp as you might out of a year's worth of regular practice. It's not the same. It's not equivalent. But, you know, this gets into what people's ideas are, what are people's paradigms of learning that they understand. The paradigms of in-depth psychoanalytic treatment versus that of, you know, so-called counseling program. Counseling programs operate on a premise that is sort of academic in nature. And part of the irony of this is the idea that what you will get in a short-term focus is sort of the emotional equivalent of a lengthier commitment. But I think this is largely not true. I think this lends itself to an intellectualized focus, because what you're going to get in a short-term focus is a kind of overview of what addiction is, and that's a kind of academic process. You'll get ideas like things that people already know, like that sex, when one is addicted to sex, it operates a bit like cocaine in the brain, and it triggers or activates your neurotransmitters like dopamine. And you can tell by the weary sound of my voice that this is the kind of thing you can get off the internet. You don't really need to, you know, immerse yourself, you know, in a program for that kind of information. You'll hear chestnuts like that, you know, addict is hardwired, you know, towards the habit forming behavior. They have a quote brain disease. Now that is grounded at least in a legitimate idea, but in terms of what the medical or psychiatric establishment has affirmed, this is really only applies to alcoholism. Alcoholism was designated as a disease by the AMA in the 1950s, but sex addiction most certainly has not been. Now, don't get me wrong. I mean, I can understand why people go to a program and, you know, they have a short-term counseling focus, and they might indeed have an emotional or what, you know, is dubbed a cathartic experience, by the way, a term, you know, derived from psychoanalysis. But it's as likely as one that would happen anyway because of the reasons they're going to the program in the first place, you know, in the aftermath of a painful, say, discovery of problem behaviors, the bottoming out experiences. So, you know, with a period of being out of denial about it, being feeling exposed and guilt-ridden and ashamed, the emotional experience was, you know, likely to happen. And people can indeed have aha moments. They can have realizations or indeed be inspired by listening to the stories of others. I'm not going to, you know, contest any of that. But in terms of learning in depth, you know, how your mind works, how your, if you like, your quote addiction works, and I'm talking about that idea of addiction that comes from, you know, the 12-step movement, and then secondarily the medical establishment, that addiction just doesn't designate, you know, the idea that you get hooked on something for, you know, 6 months or more, and that the addiction is at least a function or mostly a function of the addictive properties of the thing you're addicted to, like drugs. No, I'm speaking to that idea that gets taught in 12-step programs in particular, that addiction is a part of who you are. It's an aspect of personality, even personality disorder. And it's why people think, at least in that community, that it is incurable and something that merits attention for the remainder of life. That's a heavier thought. But, you know, what in treatment programs gets marketed? Marketing is about, and I've listened to this talking to people who have careers in sales, you know, what is the upfront idea? You overpromise. You know, you say things like, you know, you will get in a matter of days what you will receive, you know, in a year's worth of counseling. That sounds like the kind of Barnum and Bailey, you know, sort of extravagant statement one makes. Now, it's interesting that once you get a little bit further into, you know, the process of committing to a product, you know, salesmen, you know, talk about how you switch it up. And the idea at some point is to, you know, under-promise and then over-deliver. So you generate, you know, the pleasant surprise of things happening when, you know, before you even expected them to happen. And the, you know, irony number one being that, you know, the academic process, which lends itself to a, you know, intellectualized approach, you know, is born of an expectation that you'll have in a sort of emotional awakening. Irony number two is that the thing about short-term approaches, they cater or appeal to the so-called addict's predilection for immediate gratification. But it is, you know, part of their problem, this idea that they want to, quote, get past this, get rid of uncomfortable experience. Now, in theory, what you're meant to do is, when you go to a short-term program, is you're meant to continue. You know, they're meant to be in programs like aftercare. And I know this from having, you know, worked in the field of addictions, you know, for 25 plus years. Only program that I ever worked with that was a system, there was an intensive component, and then there was an aftercare, alumni meetings, what have you. You were meant to go into something like, you know, long-term individual therapy, or you were meant to do 12-step programs. You were meant to continue. But the, you know, the intensity of the, or the in-depth quality of the approach was meant to lessen over time, not deepen over the time, which is the psychoanalytic way. And since I touch on my experience, I'm going to, you know, say that some of the rationale for the longer-term approach, which I have spoken of in this podcast series, you know, is born of conversations that I would have had once upon a time that informed, you know, previous writings about how people in recovery from addiction in particular, historically, they go in and out of treatment, and they experience cross-addictions. Now, some, you know, think this is maybe overstated. The analytic author Lance Dodas makes the point that many people who get hooked on things like drugs can return to a, you know, non-addictive way of living. That isn't necessarily even a majority of people who get caught up, you know, in addictive patterns, then, you know, cross over into other addictions, what he might dub, I think he did in his book, Heart of Addiction, dub a, quote, true addiction. I think this of a lot of sex addicts, by the way, and it's one of the reasons why there is now, you know, preferred designations like problem sexual behaviors or the World Health Organization diagnosis category, you know, compulsive sexual behavior disorder, which rather like substance use disorders in the Diagnostic Standards Manual of the APA, you know, designate discrete time periods. You are not an addict, but a dependent, or you have a use disorder, addict being a cultural, not a medical term. If you have exhibited the criteria, meaning the symptoms, the behaviors, et cetera, for like 6 or more months, it's, you know, the diagnostic criteria is not about this idea of you being this way, you know, throughout your lifetime. It's about, you know, manifesting the syndrome for, you know, enough time to meet a kind of threshold. Anyway, this old experience of mine, I would sit with administrators, people who were, you know, sort of consultants to the economics of treatment programs, and they would say, you know, the average, you know, person who goes into drug treatment goes in on at least 3 separate times in their lifetime. This person, these people were talking about the economics of the business. They were talking about the business. How do you fill beds and or fill, you know, slots in treatment? You know, it's not because of just the epidemics of addiction, so-called. It's because, or that, you know, you're going to have so many, quote, customers out there. No, it's that you will have repeat customers because of something I go on and on about in this series. Addiction is about repetition, that which is recurrent. The singular derivative, I think, psychoanalytic idea is born of this notion of repetition compulsion. So you are a consumer of treatment. You are somebody who, you know, has had a bottom-out experience, maybe. Or you've had a discovery event and you have an impacted partner, a would-be codependent, whatever, who's insisting you get treatment. You want to take this seriously. And you think an intensive immersion in treatment is the way to go. And you're probably right. And you might hear that a rationale that is common, you know, for or to, you know, immersive programs and for a regular ongoing treatment, that you will more likely to reveal yourself honestly and consciously in a treatment if you engage in it in an immersive way. That your true feelings, your secrets, the thing you don't share with anyone else, will come out if you make a, you know, a fuller commitment. You become undefended. You know, it's the idea that addiction is, you know, one of many ways in which people defend themselves. They, you know, use addictions to escape. And, you know, a further part of the rationale, which is why people go into, you know, immersive treatments instead of, say, you know, once a week psychotherapy, which they might have been doing, you know, prior to a bottom-out experience. You know, the idea is what happens in between sessions? What happens in between the periods when you are revealing yourself? Well, the idea is the problem is that a problem occurs because although you might periodically reveal yourself to a trusted other in the safety of a therapeutic space, in between, we go back to our habits. In between the defenses that, you know, might lead to further addictive behaviors and other problems, they get to reconstitute. It has to do with this founding or, you know, watershed idea that Freud discovered, you know, early in his devising the scientific project, as he called it, of psychoanalysis. The patient resists, and resistance, defensiveness, is actually the norm. And we do so consciously and unconsciously. And although, you know, opinions might vary about what is a conscious defense and what's an unconscious defense, you know, lying is thought to be a conscious defense, for example. The unconscious is, you know, our habit. And habit is another word, a plain word for, you know, unconscious process. And who knows what habits, you know, whether they are daily or not, whether they, you know, trigger an addictive slide or not, you know, how important they are. You know, you can come out of a program, any kind of program that is counseling you about, you know, addiction, and you can learn some, you know, tips and good skills, like you can learn to use porn monitoring software, for example, if porn addiction is your thing. You could set up a so-called honesty accountability system, as it might be dubbed. That might be a 12-step group or, you know, some sort of trusted inner circle. Maybe honesty agreements with a committed partner, a spouse, about, you know, urges towards behavior, if not necessarily, you know, the behaviors themselves, because that might, you know, prove risky. And, you know, sometimes a spouse can be enjoined into that process if they can tolerate hearing about, you know, the urges of their partner. You commit to avoiding certain environmental triggers. You won't go to bars. You won't go to, I don't know, strip clubs. You won't go here. You won't go there. You won't accept text messages from strangers, especially strange women. You are barely scratching the surface with this plan, is what I have to say. Because if you are an addict, or if you are, you know, similar things like an obsessive, if your problem has been recurrent in your life, and I don't mean just over, you know, a discrete 6-month stretch, and you might be one of those people who would go into treatment, get out, go back again at some later time, and so on, that roller coaster, then the onus is upon you to do something a little bit beyond the surface. No, scratch that. Scratch beyond the surface. Quite a bit beyond the surface. To other kinds of triggers, deeper triggers. What do you know about what even a trigger is? What do you do with criticism? What do you do with anger? What do you do internally with those feelings? What do you do with aloneness? Do you notice depression? Do you notice anxiety? Do you call it boredom? Have you defended yourself against those feelings before they even register consciously? Who are you? So, daily treatment over the short term, days, maybe weeks, may keep you from hiding in a short term. And you can be undefended if you're meeting with someone day after day who is, you know, challenging you, got their laser vision on you, into your mind. But then what? You know, if it's a weeks-long program, if it's a 28-day-long Minnesota model-derived program, if it's, you know, like detox, can you play out the clock? Can't you do that for a spell and then feel relieved when, you know, it's kind of like the semester's over in school? What about if you had to do it for an indeterminate period? Can you do it as in not hide and have a commitment to being open and to be challenged about how conscious you are week after week, perhaps multiple times a week? Imagine meeting with someone 2 times, 3 times, 4 times a week over the course of a year. You worried about money? Okay, check out the tab that is the cost of the websites that are of the programs that, you know, take you out to some luxurious place in the hills, or, you know, you stay there and it's got a spa treatment, yoga, and, you know, you come away with lots of workbooks and whatever, and you have daily counseling for, you know, a couple of weeks or whatever. Look at how much it costs. North of 10K, I would suggest. And I put it to you, there are people who provide psychoanalytic treatments, and some of them, myself included, if you're committed, if you really are, and you have some knowledge, and you have some drive, get sessions less than 100 an hour. You'll go longer. Anyway, back to treatment and what you're going to do. What does this even look like? What does this sound like? What am I talking about here? So, you're in a session, and you're reporting about how you haven't, quote, acted out in weeks, even months. And your psychoanalytic therapist tells you where the term actually acting out comes from. Did you know that it comes from a 1915 paper by Sigmund Freud, you know, that describes acting out as a phenomenon where in action, you know, that thing we think that is, you know, speaks louder than words. It actually has a defensive function. It replaces memory, thought, and feeling. You know, the things you stop noticing. In other words, acting out is a problem, and it's not just about sex. It's about a lot of things you might do or think that displaces. Practitioner, analyst, therapist asks you what your thoughts and feelings are. You say, I don't know. You don't know because you don't know what you think and feel anymore. You got so used to acting upon those thoughts and feelings. You got so used to stuffing them down, deflecting from them. You don't know what you feel anymore. Confusion is a defense. Confusion is a defense born of hysteria. That's an old-fashioned term. You know, it's about too much emotion. Hysteria is about having excessive emotion, and it stops thinking. Or you get caught up in details. You know, we think this is very true of addicts. You know, they get into their calculations. They bury themselves in work, which is egosyntonic, which means it can be deemed a good thing. They, quote, substitute addiction of video games, which, you know, it's not great, but it doesn't betray anyone, doesn't lead to that thing called betrayal trauma. You are a person that gets into minutia and details. You can get fixed on ideas. You do think, in a way. You are obsessive, and the point of obsession, the opposite of hysteria, is to stifle feeling. You can be dissociative. You can forget things. You know, dissociative is like zoning out. You didn't mention something. You missed an appointment. You come late. You leave out details, what you might later think are astonishing omissions. You resist, again, is the point. You resist in ways you don't even notice. I'm trying, you will say, as these things are pointing out. It's understandable. Someone like me might say, because you are unconscious. You've just been unconscious for a long time, and it's continuing. And it'll continue certainly long after that 28-day rehab is over. It plays out in couple sessions. You decide in the aftermath, particularly it's true with sex addicts, you know, they think at some point, hey, I need to work on a relationship, right? You know, I need to rebuild that communication. You need to listen to the counselor who says, you know, let's look at how you communicate and what happens, and, you know, let's practice in here. So, you know, you're in a session, and there's a lot of anxiety in couple sessions, and one of you bravely says to the other, you say to your partner, you know, I'm afraid you're going to leave me. And the partner says, I'm not, you know, saying something reassuring, but with a slightly rebuking tone. Later, this partner who said, I'm not leaving, you know, who wonders, you know, they might wonder what they are doing in therapy. After all, they're not the one with the addiction problem, they might think. They say, you know, I'm kind of mad that you said that. And you, as the originator of the question, maybe the person who said, you know, I'm afraid that you're going to leave me, you might think to say, well, that's, you know, that's interesting that you're mad that I even gave voice to that fear. But hang on a minute, why didn't you say that in the couples therapy? If you thought that, if you felt that, why didn't you say it? Inhibition. Why are people inhibited? And how much are problems like addictive behaviors a reaction formation, Freud would have said, to actually being inhibited? In which case, might we not consider that addiction is a paradox? A reaction to one's natural day-to-day, natural I just mean here learned, perhaps learned very early, a pattern of stifling, of holding back. Because addiction is about a kind of letting go. Other kinds of defenses, you might need, you know, a little or quite a bit of time to think about and have attention drawn to, because habits, interpersonal habits, thinking habits. It's not like they all become so obvious and apparent in a, you know, over the course of several days of counseling. Do you focus on yourself? Can you focus on yourself? What's your capacity for trust like? I don't mean what you declare about the person you're in treatment with, or is, you know, that supportive partner whom you've betrayed, I guess. I'm talking about things like the addressing of, you know, unconscious attributions, what we call projections in psychoanalysis, the unconscious fantasies we have about who we are in any given moment and who other people are, what we think they're thinking, what we imagine their judgments are of us, which are projections of the judgments we have of ourselves. The distorted thinking that a CBT, cognitive behavioral therapist, that is, might think about, you know, the thoughts about others and self. You know, you feel an urge to, quote, act out with a sexual behavior. What is that about? You know, is it a reaction to something that is something you're neurotic about, that addiction can take your mind off of? You assert yourself in some common day-to-day way, some stress-inducing yet healthy way that habits would enable an escape from. You ask for something you wanted, like a raise at work, you know, something that induces a lot of stress. You might actually engage in an addictive habit rather than doing that. You confront another's negative attitude or a behavior. You, quote, stand up to someone, and yet it brings out the anxiety. Or you passively withdraw, and you externalize the problem of your, you know, withdrawing from conflict. You know, there's no use in telling so-and-so that thing. They're never going to, you know, they're never going to listen to me. You can even invoke 12-step cliches. I can't change people, places, and things. No, you can't. We might all agree with that principle of being powerless. But do you convert that message into not even trying to exercise your voice in the first place? What about trust? What about how it might play out, you know, in the therapeutic relationship, the analytic space, as we sometimes call it? If you are a patient, you are knee-deep in a diatribe, which culminates in a "I don't trust anyone" proclamation. You know, a counselor might, quote, explore the distortion of this thought. You know, enter the the disclosed situation the, you know, the patient has talked about and say, you know, have you thought about this from another's perspective? You know, perhaps you could think of that other person who you don't trust in this way or that way, or imagine their experience. Can you empathize with the other? All very worthy things. Things that, you know, can be easily denied, again, circling back to that externalizing defense. No, no, no. I've tried so many different times. There's no talking to them. You know, one of the oldest ideas in psychoanalysis is something called transference. You know, it's a very plain idea. It has to do with unconscious messages drawn from one's past, but the idea is that it's, you know, live in the room in the psychoanalytic relationship. It's the idea of a sort of past is ever in the present, and this is why actually psychoanalysis focuses far more on the live, the now, the here and now, as some call it, than is commonly supposed. People think we, you know, just go into a, let's just explore the family tree of events. No, it's not quite, it's not the truth. But if you were doing that attention to the life, and you were doing it over time, time here is crucial, particularly to this concept of trust, it can allow for the substance of a session to be brought into a live moment. Somebody says, I don't trust anyone. Can you not say to that person, if you've sat with them as I have for like 2-3 years and met with them week after week after week after week, and they've agreed to come back and say things like, I don't trust anyone. Can you not think that it would be an interesting thing to say? I guess then you don't trust me either. And I've had moments when such a person would look me utterly astonished that I went there. And then they have their altered moment, and they say, okay, maybe sometimes I overstate things, because it's the live that really challenges, the live experience, I mean, that challenges so-called distorted thinking. Not so much a reflection on what's happening elsewhere. You know, these are just some ideas, and there's going to be some more, because I come across this a lot. You know, people enter treatment, want to talk about addiction. And if they're talking about drugs and alcohol, something that is genuinely, you know, potentially life-threatening, of course we have to detox. You might even need psychiatry, replacement drugs to wean from symptoms, to medicate depression. But a lot of addictive behaviors, what they require is, you know, an honest and conscious reflection. People need help sort of having their pattern and the way they think, where how their minds work day to day, week to week, have it drawn attention to and making it a commitment so that something can last in that. That's part of the idea of what an in-depth treatment would provide, and it's not going to happen over a few days. Anyway, if you're one of those people who wants to go to a short-term program, do so. But think about what I'm saying after you're done with it. My name's Graham Daniels. Once again, this is Getting Real About Sex Addiction. Thanks again for listening.